And it's a hard rain's gonna fall.
A final thought about James by way of a Van Morrison song I wouldn't discover until well into the 1990s. It's all in the title. You don't pull no punches, but you don't push the river. James's problem is he didn't recognize the river, so he just kept punching. He fought gallantly, but he never stood a chance. Same thing for me, I guess, except I just didn't punch as hard. But the river got me anyway, on my 17th acid trip. December 21st, 1980. The solstice. The longest night in more ways than one. Except there was a full moon that year. You can read into it what you will, although I did do some research. It averages out to once every 19 years. So you get maybe four in a lifetime. Good a time as any for it. It being the face slap I had coming from the gods. Though there have been times I felt it was more like a gang rape. Anyway, every road has its fork. Or maybe bridge collapse is a more accurate analogy. Because I pretty much just piled off into the abyss that night. Of myself. Sorry for all the metaphors. Mixed, matched, fused, and convoluted. But this is what comes from trying to make literal sense of that which is best understood as a metaphorical realm. Here's another one. To discover new lands, one must lose track of the shore for a very long time. I believe Buckminster Fuller said that. Or maybe he was just quoting somebody else. Either way, I lost track of the shore that night for a very long time. We dropped the acid at Simon's place. A basement dive way out in Burquitlam, of all places. Where he was living with his girlfriend Angela, though she wasn't there that night. I dropped twice as much as he did, two hits to his one, for various reasons, all coalescing around the fact that I was an idiot, pushing the aforementioned river way too hard. In my defense, let's just say I did genuinely feel I was onto something, a certain indescribable wavelength that was going to put me in tune with what was really going down in the world, the universe, everything. Because there was a bad actor in the White House. John Lennon had been murdered. The Cold War was heating up. America and Russia amping up their nuclear and other stockpiles, guaranteeing that the entire human race could be wiped out at least 9 times in less than an hour. I seem to recall reading that at the time. How are these not all signs that something pivotal was afoot? That something had to give? And here I was, 21 years old, strong enough, brash enough, foolish enough, to step up and try to force some of that give. What happened that night's an extremely long story, as it was nothing if not a fall into oblivion, infinity, all the fucked up canyons, dungeons, and crevices of the gods. A trip at least halfway to hell, and not all the way back. Or maybe I should just stick with the river metaphor. Except it wasn't a river anymore, it was oceans. The ones Yes had been on about with Tales from Topographic Oceans. The all-encompassing four-part epic that explained everything about everything. Except now that I finally had it, I wasn't remotely up to it. I even saw chunks of the album cover once the hallucinations kicked in. Except they were hungry. They wanted my soul. Who knows what music got played that night? It was definitely a soundtrack, a psychedelic journey being inconceivable without one. No doubt there was even some Yes in the mix, and various other prog odds and ends. But everything failed that night. Everything I'd ever accepted and or believed as to how this reality thing worked. What anything actually was. What I was. Oh. I scrawled exactly one line in my journal that night, and that was in the very early going, the just starting to get high part. Welcome to the war zone. Maybe 6 months later, having given it a pile of thought, I wrote the following. Suppose you got blown out of space and time altogether, and here all you can do is suppose. Suppose you went somewhere beyond life and death, beyond physics, certainly beyond music. Suppose you penetrated to the God's own back room, saw the essential pattern of everything, but you weren't ready for it. It was way too much, and they definitely weren't pleased with the intrusion. I remember Simon putting on some Leonard Cohen as I was finally coming down. Though at the time I thought it was Alice the dog, morphing into God's own face and voice, or perhaps Lucifer's. I remember being amazed, but mostly terrified. What it is to be smitherated, atomized to your own tiniest pieces, then somehow recombine.
I step into an avalanche. It covered up my soul.
And yet, as an older hippie sort of guy put it to me a few months later from the back of my cab, the young man that is not confused is not on the path. I was driving him to the airport. He had a joint that needed smoking before he hit U.S. Customs. So there we were, getting high as we cruised across town, then sharing psychedelic insights and adventures. Or more to the point, I twigged that this total stranger might have some insight into my confusion. So I gave him everything, almost like a confession.
You strike my side by accident as you go down for your gold. The cripple here that you clothe and feed is neither starved nor cold.
At least I had my health and the wisdom to keep my mouth shut. I'd share my confusion with a total stranger from San Francisco, but not my parents or friends. Nobody that might actually intervene, have me committed. I'm pretty sure if you'd asked any of them about me through that period, they'd have just shrugged and said, well, he's been a little quiet lately. And then maybe, if you probed a little deeper, you might have got something about how my taste in music had taken a weird twist or two. Or maybe it was just the drugs. Because I was still doing drugs. Marijuana and or hashish, pretty much daily. Sometimes hourly. Even edging back into psychedelics. Dropping acid maybe once a month. But never a major dose. Just half a hit tops. Testing the waters. True, the higher wisdom would have been to abstain altogether. Stay the hell away from what I already knew was a very dangerous edge. But who's saying I was wise? And anyway, I'd like that edge before I went too far and fell off. The view it offered, the sense of being right there with the gods, beyond the realm of so-called reality. So like any serious mountain climber who'd had a bad fall, gotten smashed up a bit but not destroyed, of course I was going to go back. As always, a soundtrack was required. And disjointed it was for a good while. Best thought of as anything and everything, except pretty much no prog anymore, because it had failed me pretty much completely. Also nothing too intense or apocalyptic. I just wasn't up to it. My reality was jagged enough already, thanks, narrow as it was. Starting from my parents' basement, branching cautiously out from there.
You must know of one make ten.
The dense and boundless suburbia of Ronald Reagan's America, even if it was Canada. Because everywhere was America land then. Still is, I guess. The cars people drove, the crap TV shows and movies they watched, the evil radio stations polluting the overall soundscape with the likes of Toto, Foreigner, Olivia Newton-John, Asia, who were particularly hard to take, comprised as they were of former members of Yes, King Crimson, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, my former heroes.
You're leaving now. and oh my love, calm down.
I remember 1 week listening to nothing but old Van Morrison because someone's sister's ex-boyfriend had left a pile of tapes behind when he split suddenly for Europe, which is how I rediscovered St. Dominic's Preview, miles over my head when Santa gave it to me in 1972, but I was ready for it now.
Oh, my love, come tumbling down.
This was the part of me that cherished complexity starting to grow up, realizing that Prague, for all its tricks and wild bluster, was often pretty thin when it came to that most complex material of all, the human soul.
To the lion. Oh, listen, listen, listen. To the lion. Inside me.
The song Listen to the Lion gave me this particular insight. No doubt I was stoned at the time, deep in reverie. A nice one.
And I shall search my soul.
I spent a lot of time in reverie through that period.
I shall search my very soul.
But often as not, they weren't nice at all. More like those dreams where you're aware you're dreaming, but you can't wake up. Some malevolent gravity pressing down on you, smothering you. Which gets us finally to the evening I almost fell off the edge again, but this time the soundtrack saved me. Early June 1982, a Sunday. I've got the house to myself for some reason. I've been stoned all day, no doubt, and now I've wisely decided that some LSD is in order. Just a half hit to put a little cosmic light on things. I drop after supper. Like I said, not a strong dose at all. But there's still a peak, and that comes a little before sunset. I'm up in the living room, looking out on the yard, the evening shadows growing, and suddenly feeling it, knowing it. It's still in me, lurking. Whatever tore me to pieces the night of the solstice. Because it's happening again, but not as intense. Like then it had been a sledgehammer. Now it's more like a scalpel. Surgical. But every bit is terrifying, because the edge remains the edge. Doesn't matter how fast you go over. The problem is my thinking. What I'm thinking is, why bother? Why fight it? Just go with the gravity. Let it take me. It's not as if I've got anything going on in my life. No project I can devote myself to. No love. No belief in anything. No system. No ideology. No rhyme. No reason. So why bother? Why care? Why? At which point I take my leap. More of a dive, really. Because of the music that's now playing. Accepted before acknowledged. If that makes any sense. It's from a tape Simon gave me a few days ago from the radio show he started doing out at the university. A late night slot where he can play pretty much anything he wants. In this particular moment has a muted sort of machine rhythm. Everything ascending, glowing and growing, like a seed into a mighty tree. Like if there is a God in heaven, this is exactly what he'd cue up on the jukebox to lure a confused young man from the psychedelic abyss he's sliding into. This is how you could be saved. But first, you have to let go. That ongoing slow motion avalanche of your soul. Let it go. The moment doesn't last, and neither does the piece of music. Maybe just 3 minutes. But it's long enough, because now I'm looking outward. Now I'm paying attention. Because something is happening out there. Sirens, smoke, a great black cloud darkening what's left of the day. But it doesn't scare me. I'm too fascinated. Riding the moment, grabbing my headphones, my Sony Walkman, grabbing Simon's tape from the stereo, taking it with me. Down into the world that I've been doing my crazy best to avoid for well over a year now.
Guardian angel at my side, protects me wherever I roam. Wherever I roam.
The fire's further than I thought, a good mile away down near the freeway. But this just gives me time to take in all the suburban normality, the beauty and the ugly. Prestige hillside living, says the real estate billboard. I flipped the cassette to the A side by now, which I'd fast-forwarded on first listening. Too intense. But now it's exactly what I need. And now here it is finally, a house fire on Westboro Crescent. The whole block like a war zone, sirens and lights, a heavy smell over everything. It's almost dark. Magic hour, they call it in the film biz. Those final moments at the end of the day when it's neither light nor dark. The worst of the fire seems over. The fire crew dragging charred stuff from inside the house, dumping it on the lawn. But then a sudden thump from inside. An upstairs window blows out, spits smoke and fresh flame. A man cries out, audible even over the music on the headphones. He's my dad's age, allowed closer to the fire than anyone else. It must be his house. I catch his eyes, like that moment in a horror film when a man has seen too much, like he's being swallowed. But it doesn't scare me. I'm up to it. A moment of dawning, even if it's dusk. Like the gods speaking to me direct, pitching me a brand new movie. The Clash are providing the soundtrack by now, the dubbed out version of Armageddon time. So on one level it's absurd, ghetto insurrection juxtaposed against this moment of suburban apocalypse. But on another it's too true, because this is a ghetto. These people are poor, going hungry, where it counts the most. Their souls.
A lot of people. A lot of people wanna get known. I stop for tonight. A lot of people single down.
And in this movie, the main guy, that would be me, not a hero so much as just this guy who's always at least tried to be true to himself. He realizes he's finally received his orders. They've come in all scrambled, of course, so he remains confused. But that's okay. That just means he's on the path. Like the hippie said from the back of the cab a year or so ago. And it made sense, I guess, but only intellectually. I didn't get it. But now I do. Because now I can use it, this confusion, which is mine and mine alone. The suburban Armageddon moment slipping into ghetto darkness, in perfect sync with the soundtrack, which has been waiting on me for eons, since 1965 anyway. Not the snare shot, but what it released. Credit where it's due. I made that 1984 tape loop, The Dead Kennedys, from their updated version of California Uberales. 5 or so seconds of song, equaling 30 or 40 inches of half-track audio tape, spliced and looped around a table leg, played off and on all night long, New Year's Eve 1984, whenever we felt compelled.
Welcome to 1984! Welcome to 1984! Welcome to 1984!
We being the Random Insomnia crew. Random Insomnia being a weekly radio show, a UBC's CITR, and a sort of final solution to the problem of eternally awful corporate radio. Stop complaining and do your own. It was Simon's thing, really. He was the official host, the ex-student, paid-up member of the station. The rest of us were best thought of as shadow agents, all pursuing our own agendas and initiatives the rest of the week. But radio, starting midnight Saturday, had become a fulcrum, a rallying point. That place where we could bring all our cool new albums and cassettes, music and noise, lean into the mic and bullshit about this and that, anything and everything.
From the transmitter
because, like the tape loop said, it was 1984, that most pivotal of prophesied years. Yet George Orwell's eternal boot to the face of humanity was conspicuous by its absence, certainly at our quiet edge of the Western world. Which doesn't mean it wasn't getting applied elsewhere. Cold War bullshit and atrocities ongoing in all manner of hell zones. The Third World War being well underway. Not World War III, that would be the atomized end of us all. Even the most bloodthirsty of tyrants understood that. But the Third World War, that was just good business. Your El Salvador's, Nicaragua's, East Timor's, Africa in general. Wherever ages-old blood feuds could be stirred up, weapons sold, military-industrial agendas pursued for fun and profit. The rank smell of death always vaguely there at the edge of things. Hell, do enough acid was going down just across the tracks, or perhaps the freeway. Such was the accentuated reality we were imagining. Needless to say, I wasn't afraid of the intense stuff anymore. The offensive, abrasive, transgressive stuff. I mean, it was just music, right? And music was my guide now. The guru that was keeping me on the path. By which I mean, when all else is in doubt, trust the soundtrack. Which made the soundtrack my single most important concern, short of food, shelter, etc. Which made providing for it maybe my most important work. Not that I was thinking in so many words at the time. Nah, like a kid who'd finally developed a taste for spicy food, I was just going for it.
Things of disorder, so tell me that you hate me, and I will feel good.
The secret being not avoidance of intensity, but commitment to it. Keep moving and the various demons and poisons of the void couldn't get a grip on you, just ended up feeding the turmoil, which if you had the right kind of metaphorical surfboard, was a mad pleasure to ride. Or take a good mosh pit. Stand still and you get pulverized. But throw in with all the apparent violence, and it's really just a dance. You might wake up the next day with a few bruises, but those are just evidence that you've been somewhere, you've done something. You're living a life that isn't denying the turmoil at hand. But I'm getting way ahead of things. It's still 1982, summer, a little short of my 23rd birthday. I had my Armageddon moment with the gods and the Clash maybe a month ago. And now I'm at Zulu Records. Same real estate as Quintessence, different owner. Flipping through the imports when I come across the first Dexys Midnight Runners album. Good band, but it's the cover that grabs me. A grainy news photo out of Northern Ireland. A nerdy teenage schoolboy looks straight into the camera. Dazed, but not in an obvious way, because he's also curious. Why is some asshole taking his picture? The album's called Searching for the Young Soul Rebels. That's what really grabs me. What is a young soul rebel, I wonder? Thinking maybe I am. Because I definitely wasn't a punk, even if I was digging the music now. I just wasn't committed enough for the extreme fashion. Or a hippie, a headbanger, a new waver, whatever the hell that was. But maybe I was this other thing. I definitely had a soul, I guess I believe that much. And what young man with a soul wouldn't be rebellious given the evil state of the world? The cannibals running the show. Except rebel was the wrong word, I eventually concluded. Indeed, young soul rebel was the wrong term, period, as I'd discover. Associated with the British Northern soul scene of the 1970s. The right word came from a button I noticed one night at a punk show, 1983 or 84, a place called Stalag 13, which wasn't even a proper venue, just the back of an auto body shop, after hours. Pretty sure DOA were playing that night, The Spores, maybe House of Commons, Vancouver Hardcore in all its ugly, beautiful glory. But it's this tiny little kid that turns me. He's maybe 8, riding on his dad's shoulders. They shove up in front of me and there it is, a button hanging off the kid's collar. Be strong, it says. Resist. And I'm tripping on a little acid. Nothing too extreme, just a maintenance dose. More for the artificial energy than great cosmic insight. But the gods slip in anyway, deliver their latest directive. Be strong. Resist. Because that's what I am. What we all are in this room. Young soul resistors. And lowercase all the way, because nothing happening here could ever be official. Just a bunch of punks, post-punks, skeptics, sophistos, artists, whatever. Resisting all the bullshit. Trying to stay true while enduring an ongoing enemy occupation. Which, if you had half a soul, with the 1980s words they approached their midpoint. Occupied territory. The 60s revolutions had failed utterly. Ronald Reagan had been re-elected by a landslide. The yuppie rich were lounging high in their towers of opulence and cocaine, occasionally getting up to piss on the poor far below. Trickle-down economics in full effect. Which didn't mean there wasn't fun to be had. So as I was trying to explain to Chloe, my stepdaughter, the other day, except she kept getting interrupted on her cell phone. It's not punk itself that saved me, guided me, fed me in those pivotal days. But it was stuff that never would have happened were it not for punk. Which, if you extrapolate backwards, goes straight to young Bob Dylan and that snare shot. Also drugs. I mean, I know how it's supposed to play out. I got the lectures in guidance class, saw the after-school specials. Young person messes around with marijuana, progresses to harder stuff, gets hooked, then either dies in a gutter or goes mad, or does something horrible they will regret for the rest of their life. Oh, Personally, I just learned to be far more careful whilst navigating the edge. Really obvious stuff, like stay on top of the dosage. Don't trip if you're working through serious personal stuff. And here I'm speaking of psychedelics, LSD in particular. Because though I would never have said I needed psychedelics, LSD in particular, through the 1980s, I certainly appreciated having them around to accentuate things, assist me in my ongoing self-deprogramming, questioning of any and all norms, reminding me of where I actually was, in a cosmic sense, where we all were. Not in some stable zone with storm clouds maybe gathering on the horizon, but in it already. The hard rain have fallen, the apocalypse happening in all its terrible and beautiful mystery. Like a giant gumbo, simmering, overflowing, which basically gives you two choices. Despair and or conformity, which is hell either way. Or everything, by which I mean not running from the storm, but going out into it. With proper attire, of course. And the right soundtrack. Meanwhile, Angela, which sounds awful, like an afterthought. She's anything but. I've just been trying to keep her out of all this, because I see no particular value in the details of my own personal soap opera. And yet I am tracking something here that I personally experienced, and Angela was definitely there for a pile of it. And the delightful Chloe. Part of pretty much everything for 5 years, from early 1983 onward. I actually met Angela way back in the Suicide James days. She was going with Simon at the time. They broke up eventually, but stayed friends. Even after she hooked up again with her previous boyfriend, Don, who'd recently graduated law school. Angela got pregnant, they got married. It was all over by the end of 1982, Don having screwed around on her. Typical lawyer.
With electronic bait, man is nuclear fission.
And then one night out at the radio show, we connected again. She had almost 2-year-old Chloe with her, who was still between gibberish and actual English, and thus enormous fun to put in front of a microphone, mixed with various noises. Anyway, Angela needed a roommate for a place she'd found in East Van, and I was making pretty good cash at the time, and long overdue a permanent exit from the suburbs. So I moved in. We clicked. Stuff happened. Closest thing to a real family I've ever had. Except for maybe the radio show, though that was more like a marauding gang, cutting loose in the coolest possible playground, by which I mean the station's record library, a treasure trove of superlative noise, old and new, and the production studio, which is where the tape loops and such got created. It may have been only one night a week, but it quickly became the night. A creative purpose, and so much else that was going down was neither creative nor purposeful. And here I will mention a few names, fellow travelers as it were, pseudonyms all. Martin Q, Neil Darkness, Bostock, Jerome Broadway, The Twins, The Norm, Rockin' Patrick, Travis B., Vomit the Permagel, Eating Raoul, and various others I'm sure I'm forgetting. All manner of coming and going, with Simon the only real constant, so we eventually just called him Dad. Random Insomnia, every Saturday, Midnight Unto Oblivion, or Sunday morning, whichever came first. And then we switched to Tuesdays for a while, then Fridays briefly, then Wednesdays for a good long stay. Anything and everything. Love, peace, and violence. That was the official motto, and proof in advertising. Because there really were no rules other than play good stuff, not bad. Music and noise. It's all in the timing. Meanwhile, down in the gay discos and various underground dance parties, something big was happening. Two situations come to mind, both linked by a common soundtrack, which was the extended remix of Frankie Goes to Hollywood's Relax. The first was the first time I ever heard it, which was at The Love Affair, Vancouver's best dance club ever. Though some would argue that it was past its true glory by 1984, that it had become too populated with so-called breeders, and thus no longer a strictly gay and or trans situation. But I'd argue that 1984 was in fact The Love Affair's peak, because of those breeders, myself included. Because this was the moment when the various compulsions all balanced each other, when no particular tribe held sway, sexually, politically, spiritually, philosophically, yet all were being heard. Felt anyway. In the music. Not that Relax wasn't profoundly, exquisitely, educationally gay. It actually coached us all on the value of delaying orgasm, of not firing all the guns at once, which made it political, because this was a moment in history when the overall consensus among those who actually thought about things was that some level of global nuclear cataclysm was no longer an if, but a when. Yet Frankie seemed to be saying we all just needed to relax. That yes, we have this climax in us wanting out, but the more we lay back, focus on our breathing, the better it all starts to feel. By this point, I should point out, I'm no longer at The Love Affair. I'm now at a Christmas party, at a warehouse joint called Gangland, with Relax still in the mix. I'm moderately high on quality LSD, and thus seeing to the secret heart of things. How all of us in this room, regardless of hairstyle, favorite band, sexual preference, we're all relaxing, just short of climax. And thus is a new kind of energy conjured, a new light, cool and wild, and shedding its glow on the birth of a whole new age. A new Jerusalem, its great gates swinging slowly open, welcoming all. That's what the high felt like, 1984 into 1985. The low was also a gay thing. The big disease with a little name, as Prince called it a year later. The plague called AIDS. Which we'd soon discover Holly Johnson, lead guy from Frankie Goes to Hollywood, was already infected with, and thus doomed to a slow, horrible death by autoimmune dysfunction. That was the reality back in those days. Big disease, no cure. If you knew a gay person in 1980, odds were they wouldn't be alive much past 1990. At least that's how it went for me. Angela's cousin Robert, Michael Travers from high school, Jeff Turner from my university days. None of them made it to 1993, which, it's worth repeating, was a possibility we were all taking seriously in the mid-1980s.
Yourself to pay.
that none of us would make it to old age, except for maybe a few generals and politicians and their families down in some nuke-proof bunker. Because the Cold War was brewing, hot as it ever got. Not to mention that hole in the ozone we kept hearing about, bigger than Antarctica, or was it Australia? And the ice caps were all melting. I doubt the world's ever had as many possible endings as it did in the mid-1980s, which made for great radio, if nothing else. Because the music was definitely keeping up. Not the mainstream, which remained utter crap, worse even than the 1970s. With a few exceptions like Frankie, of course, and R.E.M. and U2, though they were both still pretty fringe until at least 1987. And Prince. Prince was unstoppable in the 1980s, until the Batman soundtrack, but that franchise poisoned everything it touched. Did the Violent Femmes get any mainstream airplay? The Echo and the Bunnymen? And even if they did, so much of the real gold didn't. The punk, hardcore, industrial, experimental scenes, spreading their wings, getting more and more ambitious in all manner of cool and spiteful ways. Meanwhile, the means of getting this stuff had really started to mature. New labels and distribution networks popping up everywhere. Nobody was getting rich, traveling in private jets. The cool bands from all over were recording and releasing stuff and touring.
I must look like a dork.
And we, the audience, were also managing our end. Going to the shows, buying the records. Maybe via mail order, maybe at cool stores like Zulu and Odyssey. And if we couldn't find them, we taped them. The radio station was very good for that. Hell, there was so much musical good going down, it was almost possible to ignore all the bad. Pretty sure the first time I heard Einsturz in die Neubauten was via some video that Bostock dug up. Grainy footage of evil-looking German art punks in a construction site, or maybe it was World War II rubble still lying around. They were hammering at chunks of metal, taking pile drivers to slabs of concrete, howling over it, calling it music. Impressive. But it didn't strike me as what my soul required. Though I did like the name, difficult as it was to pronounce. Einsturz in die Neubauten. Translating as collapsing new buildings. It was the arrival at the radio station of their Yugang 12-inch single that changed things. End of 1985. The B-side got queued at the wrong speed. But we were high and didn't notice it until it was too late. Let's just say it did something to me. Which gets us to January 1986. The amazing exploding space shuttle, as Simon referred to it one night, a little drunk.
No communication. No explanation.
We
you've grown used to the idea of space.
In the aftermath of the tragedy, Ronald Reagan got a lot of coverage for quoting a poem about man daring to touch the face of God, which prompted Bostock to say, well, maybe that's the problem right there. Maybe God doesn't like having his face touched. This sounds callous now, but trust me when I say, he really had to be there. Because beyond the immediate shock, I'd be lying if I didn't say that my main feeling in the wake of the Challenger fuck-up was something akin to relief. To finally see any mud in the eye of Ronald Reagan's America and all the smug, yuppie ugliness it was imposing on the world. Because like they said at the time, that guy was made of Teflon. Nothing stuck to him. But maybe this would. I can't say I'm proud of it now, politicizing the deaths of those involved. But it was a stark moment of realization, just how far I'd strayed from the norm. ...1986 was also Expo year in Vancouver. A World's Fair, which meant 5 or 6 months of solid traffic jams, rent hikes, evictions, ugliness, bullshit. I wasn't a fan. Nobody I knew was. It just wasn't in our mindset to think that way. But my parents were fans, my dad in particular. So I ended up with a pass, care of his company. I still remember the first day I went, me and Simon. We dropped a little acid and...
This is what you want, this is what you get. This is what you want, this is what you get. This is what you want, this is what you get.
It was just a prefab mall, basically. But so much worse, because it was pretending to be so much more. And thus it magnified everything that was wrong with the culture of this wannabe world-class city I was fast-growing embarrassed of. That this was the best we could do. Throw up some temp structures made mostly out of plastic. Add some laser light shows. People lining up for everything. Nothing ever worth the wait. It must have been a Wednesday, because I remember we couldn't get out to radio fast enough afterward. And the first song I queued up was Anarchy in the UK, the Sex Pistols. Because nothing else was up to it. The convolutions of psychedelicized rage and disgust I was feeling. A 10-year-old record, but only now that I truly get it. Nothing personal, understand. I'm sure individually these passers-by were all fine people, but all crowded together, standing in line in their stupid t-shirts, all those way too bright 1980s colors, they really did need to be destroyed. Figuratively, of course. Which gets us back to Einstürzen de Neubauten, who'd been booked to play at a venue called the Xerox Theater, which was located toward the west end of the expo site, near the world's first floating McDonald's. My memory tells me it was early July sometime, but Motron insists it was no later than the end of May. It was definitely raining by showtime, I'm clear on that. Nothing heavy, just a light summer, or perhaps spring, mist. And of course, I was working a nice, light acid buzz, enjoying all the bustle and contrasts. All these earnest consumers from all over the world. There's nothing a consumer wants more than a freebie. Just wander into the Xerox, open air, although it did have a roof. Grab a seat, and enjoy some unique West German cultural exchange. I'm still trying to figure out how they got booked. Either by some bureaucratic drone way out of their depth, or a conceptual genius. I'm hoping for the latter. It's not like there was any foreplay. The 5 or 6 sort of goth punk gentlemen just wandered onto the stage, and proceeded to call down war, pestilence, disease, death. Einstürzen plowed right through us that night, with true heavy metal music. They had actual chunks of heavy metal on stage. They were hitting at them, grinding them. Here's Here was Full On Truth, straight out of Berlin, Cold War, divided city. That place on planet Earth where the two opposing powers of East and West found their most intense point of contact, friction, heat. Also Chernobyl, because if this really was May of 1986, and now that I've thought about it, I'm pretty sure Motron is right, then the nuclear meltdown at Chernobyl in the Ukraine had happened just a few weeks previous. Contaminated fragments of actual apocalypse caught up in various winds and stratospheric currents, falling back to Earth, who knows where. Maybe falling right now, right here, this situation of burning industrial strength soul music, setting even the rain on fire. Because it was raining now, no longer just a bit of drizzle. And I was out in it. How would that happen? I guess it was all the normal folks, trampling for the exits, like someone had shouted fire. Actually, there was a fire, the band tossing burning rags around, the smell of it chemical and heavy, reminding me of the house fire on Westboro Crescent, my twilight moment of epiphany and confusion almost exactly 4 years previous. And here I was, still confused, still on the path, letting the music be my guide. It took me from the Xerox Theater into the surrounding plaza, the sound a visible thing now, defined by the swath it was cutting through the surrounding crowds, a great vacuum forming around the theater. I recall this mother with two little blonde-haired girls, both of them crying. She was shouting at her husband, enraged. I don't care what you say. Music like this does something to people. It does something. I laughed, perhaps diabolically. Of course it does, Mum. It makes them see things as they really are. And then I saw it, how the music had carved its void into the floating McDonald's, maybe 50 yards away. People were screaming, trying to escape, leaping into the waters of the inlet. But there was something in the water, churning up the surface, making everything boil. Hammerheads, I heard someone shout. And then the restaurant exploded. And then carnage, as hundreds of hammerhead sharks, no doubt drawn to the barge by leaked cooking oil, chowed down on dozens, maybe hundreds of doomed fairgoers, everything pulsing and throbbing in a vicious orgy of plasma and disconnected flesh, guts, bones, other human pieces. And the band just kept playing, kept pounding, grinding, like they had no idea what was going down. Yeah, right.
That concludes episode 2 of Superlative Noise, Philip Random's story in his own words. The final episode will be starting up shortly, again once we get the jukebox properly tuned, here on CITR, FM 101.9, radio that comes to you from the University of British Columbia. Please stand by.